Bismillah, alhamdulillah, wa salatu wa salamu ala rasulillah, wa alihi wa sahbihi wa man wala. So as a bit of kind of light relief after your serious work during today's program, I thought I'd offer some rather unacademic and randomly sequenced thoughts about how we might understand what, according to Elon Musk, is the principal threat facing human beings. He says it's not climate change, it's not all of the terrifying things that his own scientists are doing, it's not AI, it's not nanotechnology, it's not nuclear conflict, it's the collapse in the birth rate. We used to think of the demographic crisis in terms of Mother Earth sinking under the weight of all of those babies, but things recently have taken an unexpected turn in the opposite direction, according to Mr. Musk. Well, he's doing his own bit. He has 11 children, I think, so we can't accuse him of hypocrisy in this particular area. It's something that we need to think about and see the relationship which this aspect of human dysfunction might have to some of the things that you people have been studying over the last few days, and indeed the last few months. To what extent is the problem of reproduction up here somewhere? Are we messed up? Some of you might have averted their eyes after peeping at the opening ceremony of the Paris Olympics last weekend. I think if you watched the full 4 hours, you'd be in danger of losing your immortal soul, because just about every one of the seven deadly sins was gyrating and doing its stuff for the benefit of the global audience. A kind of grand guignol, a kind of cabaret act that you see later in the evening in some of those clubs in Montmartre, to do with the fact that in a secular society, all that remains to us is the physical, the body. That's all we are. Even those things which the humanists of the 18th and 19th century thought they could somehow tweezer out of the clutches of the physical scientists, consciousness, creativity, the romantic reaction against that physicalism, it's all collapsed. We are just the river out of Eden, the selfish gene. The universe is nothing more, according to this dominant civilization, than matter and energy, or both. So if this is where they are, in the city of, you know, the Lumière, the great city of the first global reflex against religion, the city of Diderot, the revolution, Condorcet, the conversion of Notre Dame into a kind of funky temple of reason, and they now have this to say, that is to say, the Olympics is kind of the perfect modern festival, because it's just about the body. Do you think that all of those bodybuilders and beach basketball players, or whatever they are, could really hold their own in a philosophy seminar? Probably not. That's not how they're trained, but it's the body, and in a sense that's a faithful representation, and it's like a modern pilgrimage, the pilgrimage to the body. Which is why the church banned it, of course, in the time of the Emperor Theodosius, because it was a physicalist, fleshly thing that was also associated with the paganism, which Christianity in his day was busily extirpating. But yeah, in the heart of Paris itself, France, the eldest daughter of the church, Notre Dame, the martyrdom of St. Denis, Saint Louis, all of those major episodes in the evolution of Western Christian civilization, the place where Thomas Aquinas studied. Now all they can represent is, in this festival of athleticism, the body gyrating, pierced, tattooed, perhaps eccentrically shaped and gendered. And the culmination of it seemed to be a kind of what Piers Morgan described as a kind of I forget his his words, a kind of drag queen inversion of the Last Supper in the conventional image of Leonardo. So somehow the festival of the body and the functions of the body and the beauty of the body and the discipline of the athlete, the way to introduce this is this kind of cabaret thing. In the city of St. Denis, that's what remains. And this is why Nietzsche said, we don't know what we have done by killing God. He didn't actually say God is dead insofar as he was sure that he didn't exist. Towards the end of his life, he had, well, at the end of his sane life, he had some very interesting quasi-religious epiphanies, but he could kind of foretell where we were going if all that was left of us is just flesh and blood. This spectacular, this amazing thing, which didn't really seem to signify very much, seems to be where we now are. But what you didn't see in this kind of celebration of slightly kinky life, which went on in the rain for hours, even Keir Starmer kind of got fed up and vanished after the umpteenth display of new sexualities kind of paraded before him, and he kind of went off to find an umbrella or something. It was kind of a bit repetitive. And generally, that sort of fin de siècle, ancient Roman, orgiastic, Dionysian thing is always pretty predictable. There's a limit to how many things they can say if they no longer believe in the infinite. It's kind of recycling of old tropes. The Emperor Nero would have been perfectly happy. And, of course, one of the key figures was the god Dionysus, naked, blue, not doing anything particularly meaningful, of course. A meaning deficit is what it all signifies. But this indicates the strangeness and the unprecedented, not even late Roman, because at least the Romans had, you know, they had the Eleusinian mysteries and Bacchus, and Dionysus was actually the head of a particular kind of cult. Now it's just a symbol that symbolizes nothing. What has happened to the human brain now that it has been told that it's just another aspect of physicality? It tends to go down into this cabaret world. So we ponder the significance of this, but what you didn't see in this endless series of different human forms was anything that related to the principle of life. If we are physical beings, we are living beings. We are all organic, with the exception perhaps of the fillings in our teeth, or those of us who are moving towards the stage where we look forward to hip replacements and that kind of thing. But basically, we're organic beings, and we are part of the normal cyclicity of the organic world. And key to that, of course, is that cyclically we reproduce ourselves. That's the key aspect of our organic nature. And yet you didn't see any references to parenting in those 4 hours, or to having children, or the presence of children. It's all just single adults having fun. And the fundamental aspect of our physicality, of our embodied nature, was kind of airbrushed out as kind of middle-class, suburban, bourgeois, parental stuff that is definitely uncool. So there's something quite emblematic about this paradox of modern civilization, which on the one hand says we are only the organic, and we only have one purpose, from Darwin to Jared Diamond and so forth, Daniel Dennett, which is to reproduce ourselves, because that's the only purpose of living things. Everything in every aspect of their lives and their adaptation to the world is simply there so that they can reproduce and generate. But now we seem to be in a point in civilization where we agree that we are only biology, and yet in terms of the purpose of biology, we're failing. Children are not there, and increasingly children are not a reality of the modern world. One of the ironic twists of the turn to physicality is that we are denying the fundamental telos, purpose, direction, end of our physical nature. And you can tell people this. Your civilization has failed completely because you say we are just biology, and yet biologically we're a fail. A species that has a collapsing birth rate is a fail, according to Darwin, Dennett, all of the others, they don't usually like to be told that. And their missionary impulse towards trying to get everybody else to conform to their ideas of gender and sexuality and the family and opportunity and equality is undiminished by the fact that they are heading towards kind of a black hole of infertility. Visit a typical British embassy in the Middle East, for instance. Well, they do a few useful things like replacing your passport if you've lost it and that kind of thing, or charging you £4,000 for a visa if you're visiting from wherever. But mainly they seem to do two things as far as I can see. Firstly, they're kind of British aerospace dealerships urging the purchase of new weapons and bombs and jets and tanks on the local population. That seems to be kind of their main function. And secondly, they have these earnest commissars who are trying to encourage local populations, the backward natives, the Muslims, whatever, to trade up to the West's ideas about gender, sexuality, the family, etc., 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 couched in terms of rights. Very odd. So they're dealers in death on the one hand, and on the other hand, they're trying to do things with the traditional structure whereby life is brought into the world. But they can't think of not doing that, or how colonial they are, in fact, with their claim that only their universals are true universals, and the poor old Egyptians and Bangladeshis and Congolese, of course, don't have real universals. They have to accept the universals of the West. They can't really accept that, because, after all, what else do they have? What other message do they have in their millennial mission to help everybody up the chain of evolution to become as wonderful as their Western selves? Without that, they're kind of bereft. So it's become a very odd situation, and obviously something is wrong up here. Now, there are physiological reasons for the decline in the birth rates, which have complex reasons which are poorly understood. The sperm count in Western countries is going down on average by 1% a year. Nobody really knows why. Microplastics, hormone pollution, the loss of male self-respect. These are all theories. Even, I saw this one, the habit of keeping powerful mobile telephones in one's trouser pockets is allegedly a cause of this. But we don't really know, but it's statistically a fact. Testosterone going down 1% every year, the traditional hormonal driver of masculinity, psychic as well as physiological, it's all dipping and becomes a kind of crisis issue. So it looks as if modernity is what they call a non-communicable disease. Diseases like cancer or thrombosis or diabetes that you can't catch from people, and that in traditional people living in rainforests or whatever, pretty unusual. People get communicable diseases in the state of nature, but not these modern diseases. So we can say anything that looks like an epidemic that is affecting this fundamental aspect of our biological nature is a kind of sickness. It's a disease. And Jung talked about this a long time ago. Many of you will know a lot more Jung than I do, that the characteristic epidemic of modernity is the meaning deficit. From ancient times, human beings and their cerebral and their cultural adaptation has been rooted in the certainty that everything means something. You're living in the rainforest in the Upper Paleolithic, and you know exactly who made what tree and what happens after death and what spirit lives it. It's kind of the world is spiritualized and magical, and the brain is designed for that world, to see stuff behind the surface of things. But now, with these first generations in the thousands of generations of mankind that doesn't have that any longer, that suffers from this meaning deficit, something's going on up here, something that seems to be reaching epidemic proportions. So we can say secularity, atheism, if you like, is a kind of mental illness. That's not a polemical statement. It's just how things are, because we're not designed for it. we're designed to find meaning in things, whether you accept the kind of Freudian interpretation of the origin of religion or the Durkheimian view that it's all about coping with terrifying forces and seeing that other people are making big sacrifices in order to keep the show on the road. These are all, strikes me as rather wild examples of guesswork. It doesn't really matter. What's normal to us is to have belief. And that belief is usually associated with natural cycles and particularly the human cycle. Birth, marriage, conception, pregnancy, childbirth, death. It's kind of the universal aspects of our embodied biological nature. But now we've kind of stepped outside that cycle because we can do other stuff. And so we have what you might call the biopause. This is a crisis, we might as well give it a word. The biopause, it seems to me, has two stages. Biopause one is where humanity, malfunctioning because of this non-communicable disease, steps outside the normal harmony with the other orders of nature and becomes a kind of parasitical destructive principle. Sometimes this is called the Anthropocene, where we become a kind of virus on the surface of the planet that can't live in harmony with other species but exist at their expense. Unless, of course, you're a sheep or a pig in a factory farm or something, in which case things might be relatively comfortable. But overwhelmingly, you're guilty of what the Qur'an would identify as a kind of genocide. If the Qur'an says the other species, the birds and the animals, are umamun amthalukum, nations like yourselves, and we know from the prophetic example that we have responsibilities, moral responsibilities towards other living things, they're kind of people, so we can say, yeah, it's a genocide. So that's, you know, biopause number one, and that's got the world in a panic because of the loss of biodiversity. Biopause number two is where it kind of hits us as a species and where we start to decline, despite the fact that the neoliberal system, which we've evolved with its considerable technical and administrative brilliance, is exploiting the other biotic orders of creation in order to make ourselves more comfortable and live longer, have better antibiotics or whatever, palliative care. The fact is we're not doing this most fundamental thing, which is having babies. And the reality of this is kind of dawning not just on Elon Musk, but on everybody. Last week I was in Italy with the CMC group. We go there with our Darul Uloom graduates and we explore the wonders of the Vatican and they meet trainee priests and so forth. It's a good part of their training. And people there are usually very hospitable and tolerant towards us. But in Italy, the average woman only has 1.2 babies. This is in the homeland of the Catholic Church, which is supposed not to let you use any form of what they call artificial conception. So you walk through the streets there, and it's Italy, everybody's very cool. They're in the latest kind of chic stuff, and the shirts seem to be perfectly pressed even in the afternoon, and nobody is overweight, really. It's kind of cool people. Diet is healthy. And yet you see a lot of closed schools, not many buggies, unless it's either tourists from America who do tend to bring their kid, you can see that, or it's the Bangladeshis who go to the catacomb mosques because Meloni has been closing mosques quite busily and it's kind of surreptitious. Like Christians in ancient Rome, it's kind of in the catacombs and hiding. And they, we could say, whatever other things the Ummah might be getting wrong, there's at least one thing that we still know how to do. Babies proliferating. And this has become one of the key neuralgic issues for European politics. On the one hand, they know that the elites are no longer reproducing. And on the other hand, they can see that the only solution is immigration, which is political suicide and which is, you know, changing the entire political landscape across Europe, with Le Pen almost very nearly getting in last month in France with her kind of neo-Vichy idea and deputies' intention to have a hijab ban, etc. The usual Islamophobic rhetoric, which is kind of normalised now. So Europe is really caught in this very difficult situation. on the one hand, people are too cool now to want to have families and babies. It just gets in the way of living the life. Or they're bipausal because of certain hormonal or fertility shifts. But on the other hand, the only possible solution, which is to bring in young people from overseas, they don't fancy that either. The Italian government has been spending billions trying to get people to reproduce. It doesn't seem to work. The rate continues to go down. The replacement rate for humanity is 2.1 babies per mother. The 0.1 is because there's infant mortality and other risks. So it has to be slightly above the 2. That's the replacement rate. But if it's going down to half of that, then it's a problem. So the Italian province that has the lowest birth rate is actually Sardinia. And in inland Sardinia, there's nobody around. There are whole deserted villages, maybe with one or two old people who are still hanging on. The young people, if there are young people, they've all gone off to Frankfurt to flip pizzas or something. But it's kind of deserted. So the second most common language now in upland Sardinia is actually Kyrgyz. There's a fun fact for the day. Why? Because there's nobody around to look after the sheep and do the stuff that you do in the Italian mountains. And so the Kyrgyz embassy in Rome has a nice little number whereby they bring in Kyrgyz, and everybody in Kyrgyzstan knows about goats and sheep. It's kind of, they're brought up with it. And so up in the mountains in Italy, you find Kyrgyz Muslim herders. This is the strangeness of the situation that Europe now knows that it's facing. And in the Far East, it's even worse. The country with the lowest birth rate is Korea at the moment, which continues to tank and to tank and to tank. In Seoul, the capital, the average woman has on average half a baby, which is a quarter of what it ought to be. And the Korean government has spent $200 billion trying to change that, with endless paternity leave and tax breaks on nappies. Doesn't seem to work. There's no political solution to this. So they're going to have to bring in more immigrants from Indonesia or the Philippines, and they don't want that either. But what happens to an economy in that situation? Well, you have an aging population. In Italy, the average person is now 48 years old, and it continues to rise. You have more and more people who need expensive health care and palliative care and care homes, etc., and fewer young people to pay the taxes who are going to support that, and you have an economic collapse. And already countries like Japan are kind of a bit weak economically because there aren't enough young people to pay for the care for the old. In China, also really bad, there are partly because of the one-child policy, which they had until about 15 years ago, which really messed up their demographic curve, but also because as a result of that policy, many parents were legally or illegally aborting female children. You have 30 million more young men than young women in China. Mass abortion based on gender. And whatever they say about the Muslim world, that generally is not a statistic that you find. You get in India, you don't get in Pakistan, etc. It's something that we've been able to avoid. So this is, according to Mr. Musk, the number one problem. And it's become certainly the number one political problem for Europe now. And the number one cultural problem, because you have 4 hours of gyrating, very expensive athletes turning cartwheels in the nude, in various new epicene forms of humanity, and everybody says diversity, diversity. it's diversity in terms that the elites understand. Diversity for the elites means including everything that they think should be included. But you didn't see any niqabs on trapezes. That's not diversity, no. It's very transparent. So there's a number of things that ride on this. What is it? What's the significance of this for the Muslim world? Well, as I said, you know, Muslims still are able to have children, and by and large, birth rates are above the replacement rate across the Islamic world. And actually, the country that has the highest rate in the world is actually Niger. The average woman in Niger has like 6.5 babies, which is... that's the average, which is, I guess, kind of makes you think. But out of the six most fertile countries in the world, four are actually Muslim, and two are not Muslim. Sub-Saharan Africa, they're still reproducing. So what does it mean when, by the year 2070, on current projections, there will be more people in Nigeria than in the whole of Western Europe? And in Western Europe, it'll be mostly old folks hobbling around on Zimmer frames, helped by Mr. Musk's robots, maybe, and maybe that's a sort of solution. We're looking at something that is very, very serious. So now, to dial in the kind of Islamic interpretation of this. What we note in our scripture is really a focus on the principle of life. It's one of the most striking things in the Quran. It talks about the cycles of nature. It talks about the springtime, about the rain that comes down and brings up life from even the desert. The paradisal realm is interpreted as an abode of life. Al-Hayawan, the Quran even calls it life with a capital L. So in our timetable for the human story, we come from the Garden of Eden, perfect life, like a botanic garden, but without the moths that eat the rose leaf, perfection, the archetype of nature. And we are heading, we hope, for the final pure version of that garden. And in the interim, there is this kind of rather complicated thing that we find ourselves in. So we see the human origin and return, Alpha and Omega, in terms of life and life. And the fiery possibility, which is what happens when we're not really interested in being in a harmonious situation with ourselves, with others, with the other gender, with nature, with God. The fire that we kindle in our hearts is a kind of zone of sterility. And this is really a very characteristic feature of the Quran, and it leads the French Orientalist Louis Massignon, who's probably my favourite sort of Christian theorist of Islam. Some people say he converted, some people say he didn't. There's endless legends about him. He died about 60 years ago. Looking at the Quran's focus on nature and on the way in which the Muslim life is determined by the cycles of nature, even when we pray, it's determined by what the sun is doing. The lunar month is the month that we use, which is, even the Romans didn't use the lunar month. It goes way back. It's archaic, shamanistic, primordial something. He calls Islam the great remontée, the going back up to an ancient style of religion. Looking at this focus on nature and this focus on the sun and the moon, and it's monotheistic, it's not shamanistic, but there's something ancient about it, which he thinks relates to the fact that it is the final, he did believe this, cycle in revelation, which is not just encompassing the monotheistic Abrahamic thing, Mosaic, Jesus, etc., but encompassing all of those nameless human generations before the wheel, before writing, when we were just part of nature, and the biopause was an impossibility. So that's helped us to understand why the Quran is always talking about the natural world and the creatures that creep on four legs and the birds that fly with two wings and being nations like yourselves. There's nothing like that in the biblical narrative at all, certainly not in the New Testament. Nature is something that the Quran wishes to draw our attention to and wishes us to be attentive to in stillness. يَتَفَكَّرُونَ فِي خَلْقِ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ. They think about the way the heavens and the earth are created. Have they not seen? Have they not seen all of these things that really an invitation to go out into virgin nature and just not do very much? Like primordial humanity, who usually wasn't very busy, kind of sitting around picking lice out of his wife's hair or something by a stream in the New Guinea rainforest, whatever it is they did, but they had a lot of time talking all the time. Anthropologists say primordial humanity, always talking. And there is something of that in this, the khatmiyya of Islam, the sealingness of it, that we are taken back not just through the Abrahamic thing, through the Kaaba and the Hajj, but also to really ancient times. And that is part of the prophetic charism as a Nabi al-Ummi, the unlettered prophet. There is something of him, of the seer, the deliverer of mantic utterances, the one who is covered with a mantle, who doesn't do writing and those other things which Plato saw as being a kind of sign of human decline. Truly the man of fitra. Medina is a kind of reprise of something really ancient. Islam not coming from the Roman or the Greek world, but from something Paleolithic. So Massignol's interested in that as kind of characterising what sort of Abrahamic religion Islam is. But an aspect of this is, of course, that the Qur'an also talks a lot about women, pregnancy, the fetus, the embryo, children. As far as I can see, that's really not very biblical, for whatever reason. I may be completely wrong. There may be some wonderful psalm about the embryo, but I can't recall it. And of course, modern Muslims, in their usual apologetic way, say, oh, look, this is a miraculous anticipation of 21st century science, and therefore Islam is true, and they feel a bit less worried. Not talking about that. We're talking about the fact that the Qur'an wishes to draw our attention to the seed, conception, the womb, rahim, families, al-arham, the wombs. It doesn't even say family, it says the wombs. That's what connects us. And to the miracle of birth, and in Surah Maryam, the dignity and the agony of birth. It's always totally respectful. So we need to think about this. Why is this principle of life so big in our scripture? In this desert place in Arabia where, you know, you're lucky to see an acacia tree in the distance every third day, is kind of Mars-like aridity. And particularly the emphasis on human life. And the insistence that we contemplate it. It's obviously quite a beautiful thing. No pregnancies in the kind of Olympic thing there, that would be really uncool to have a pregnant woman there. A lot of kind of middle-aged men who look kind of pregnant, but that's what they said about COVID when they thought that would sort the birth rate problem, that by the end of the lockdown everybody would either be pregnant or look pregnant. Even that didn't get people changing their lifestyles. This is the religion which really respects and venerates and asks us to respect and venerate maternity. And, of course, anybody who has been pregnant or seen it or studied it knows what an incredible, extraordinary summation of the human condition this is. Men don't have, with their relatively sort of comparatively primitive technology, anything that is so overwhelming. But there it is in the Qur'an, the janin, the life, the cycles, the angel comes, breathes in the spirit, subhanAllah. And that's a normal human sense of wonder. That's what makes the little girl, when she's 2 years old, realize that she's a little girl and how amazing that is, that she sees her mother is pregnant, and then she realizes, one day I'm going to have a baby in my tummy. And her... that amazing realization, kind of like alchemy, changes the way in which she understands herself. It's a very proud thing. And she gets the doll and becomes, gets the doll's house. And that's just a fact in every human culture. That's her initiation into the wonder of the prospect of modernity, of maternity. So this is kind of a little bit obvious. And if you go to maternity hospitals, you kind of see it. Generally, hospitals are kind of miserable places where people are trying not to die, kind of. But maternity hospitals are the opposite, where you see the wonder of new life and the inherent unlikeliness of a human being emerging from a single cell, from nothing. It's the Quran. That very early verse talks about the alaqa, the alaq, the clot of blood. The first revelation talks about this life that is within her and then develops into a human creature. Fatabarakallah, ahsan al-khaliqeen, blessed be God, the best of creators. And however secular and jaded and cool they are, they can see that something amazing is happening. I remember once in a maternity hospital late at night, I'd gone to get a new newspaper or something because my wife was being slow and I wanted something to read. So you can see the women who've just had babies in the middle of the night. There was one woman who was kind of looking at the baby in its little plastic crib, and you could see this was the most amazing thing that had ever happened to her, and she was touching it, couldn't believe it. Tabarakallahu ahsan al-khaliqeen. It's the most extraordinary thing, and it is a charism, a privilege of the female state, and it's like that for other orders of creation. Everything that's living apart from plants that have more modest procedures. But and that is emphasized very much in the Quran as a sign. So we need to think about that in connection with how we deal with this biopause. What we must not do is click on any of the videos of mischief makers of the type of Andrew Tate, which is often a kind of addiction for young Muslim men, and is just poisonous because it's all ego. There he is with his Bugatti and all of these teenage girls skimpily clad, and that's the opposite of Sunnah, anything. Certainly not. It's the religion of modesty, not the religion of bling. But still, some Muslim men who feel that the culture is absolutely negative towards masculinity and boys are problematized in the schools and their natural buoyancy is crushed, they kind of retaliate by looking at that stuff, which is, anything ego is from Fir'aun, not from Musa. It's fairly obvious. So then the question is, what is the practical implication for us and for human fertility and for the proper functioning of the brain? Because there's all kinds of indications that our lifestyle is so far from what we're designed for that we're really getting sick. And even our children are getting sick with new allergies and OCHD and all of these new initials, which have gone up fivefold since 2019, to get a referral in the NHS for that diagnosis. On average, the waiting list now is 8 years. The system is completely collapsing because of these new issues. Something is really wrong, and we don't know how sustainable it is. So the basis here is to take seriously the Quran's insistence that we are at ease and peaceful and happy when we are in a state of Iman. And Iman doesn't really mean belief. Belief is a more superficial thing. I believe that Putin is in the Kremlin, and it's kind of propositional. Iman comes from a very different root, which has the sense of security, a secure awareness of how things are, which is what you get if you're in virgin nature for a long time. And of course, you realize that this stuff comes from somewhere and that there is the sacred all around you. It's kind of inescapable. And every primordial people that existed in virgin nature had that awareness, although sometimes their rituals, their expression of that were not exactly Sharia compliant, but they all had that awareness. So how do we get back to that? In other words, Iman not as a belief generated by the fact that there's scientific miracles in the Quran, hooray, but an Iman generated by the heart's contemplation of the miraculous and spiritually pregnant, if you like, presence of nature. How do we get back to that when we're living far from nature? when we're living, working in modern hospitals or law firms, and the only sign of nature is some kind of indoor plant that's imprisoned in a pot, looking a bit oppressed and sad in the corner. That's all the nature that you'll see. Well, how do we get back to this world of shuhud, of contemplation? Well, we can do so through the face, through the contemplation of the human other. We are all part of the natural world, and you can walk through the departures at JFK, and there's not much to inspire the spirit, to put it mildly. But there's other human beings. If you have travelled with the awliya, you'll see that they are preternaturally scanning those crowds for spiritual nourishment, because it's part of the divine decree that every human being, every genetic shuffle, if you like, every concatenation of atoms, every arrangement of the divine qualities in a human being is different and irreplaceable, which is pretty amazing. So the wali, when he sees a human being, believing or non-believing, says, what is the unique manifestation of the divine tajalli in this particular form? So they say, la takrara fit tajalli. God's self-manifestation is never repeated. Each one is telling you something. So in that environment, the awliya are kind of looking for spiritual nourishment by seeing the beauty in other people. They want to see the parents that are looking after their children. They want to see somebody who's helping somebody with a wheelchair, whatever. All of those ethical manifestations, and just the beauty and the improbable fact of conscious human beings. And that can be a spiritually healing phenomenon. So this is what we might call shuhudi humanism. Humanism based not on the fact that, oh, well, human beings, unlike other creatures, can build jets and go to the moon and stuff, and therefore we're special and should be respected. But instead, a humanism based on the reverence for other human life, because we know that Allah has created human beings fi ahsani taqwim, in the best of forms, and there is more to remind us of and to reflect the divine creative power and the divine nature in a human being than in anything else. Which is one reason why in our tradition we don't like pictures very much, because a picture is always an artist's underestimation of the actual presence of a human being. The real woman whom Manet is painting must have been much more amazing than this two-dimensional image that is there in the Louvre or wherever. It's a potentially blasphemous underestimation of the message, the witnessing, the shahood that's supplied by the actual presence of another human being. So this is, again, part of our primordiality, that we consider the miracle of humanity rather than just rights and responsibilities and equalities, and the only way in which modernity can deal with these frail bodies that sooner or later are going to be sent off to the crematorium. Places for the locus of an immortal spirit, which does miraculous and strange things to the face and to behaviour and is endlessly fascinating. This also, it seems to me, relates to the way in which gender and what nowadays is called, at least by some feminists, although some of them don't like the word, gender equality, which very often seems to take the form of if we change society and we change the way men think and we crush the patriarchy, then 50% of all parliamentarians will be women and 50% of all jet pilots and soldiers, and then we'll have equality and there's no justice without equality. Seems to be the way they think. And then, of course, that comes up against, and this is where the biopause kicks in, the fact that 100% of people who get pregnant still are women. It's not quite fashionable to say that, but it's a reality. And then the women might say, well, we want to do other things as well. And the system does tend to say, well, yes, but the work comes first. You have to be equal earners, equal participants in the rat race or the world of fulfilling job opportunities. And it can be very oppressive for a lot of women who feel the body clock and want to be fruitful. And it's deeply rooted, again, the life impulse is the most fundamental thing within us. And they said they're told to be equal. You have to get your PhD as soon as the man gets the PhD, and blah blah. And everybody knows this is kind of a problem. But it is one of the factors for the collapse in the birth rate. Not just women delaying it until they hit the wall and it's too late. Because after the age of 30, you've only got a 50-50 chance of conceiving. And very often they say, oh, the PhD, and then the job, and then the fellowship, and then perhaps I'll fit it in. A recent survey of French teenagers indicated that motherhood was nowhere amongst the top 10 things they wanted to do when they were adults. But eventually they think about it. It's a real trauma that modernity, this neoliberalist version of feminism, has inflicted on a lot of women who end up, you know, being single or being confused or single mothers or various erratic situations. Within 15 years, 50% of American women will be living alone. The birth rate continues to tank. And the Instagram, social media, cool culture, even the dating culture is not really designed to that. You know, the male-female gaze is ultimately about the miracle of the child. That's what it's for. But if it's just in two dimensions on Tinder or whatever, it's just about hooking up the child as well. That's kind of 20 years of expense and uproar, isn't it? And I'll postpone that. So this can be a very real trauma. And a lot of Muslim women are caught up innocently in the same thing. What is interesting is that the kind of manosphere blaming of women doesn't seem to work very well in the Islamic context. Because part of the divine wisdom in the Holy Prophet's multiple marriages is that you can see that there's many ways of being a mother of the believers. If it had just one wife, every woman would have measured herself against that ideal, and every man would have said, I want to marry that ideal. She has to be 27 and from whatever, or she's working, she's not working, she's divorced, not divorced. He has such a wide range of wives. And if Andrew Tate or whoever comes along and says, or Vance, America's future vice president, possibly, says that Kamala Harris is a frustrated, childless cat lady, whatever he called her. This is pretty horrible. We don't know her circumstances. And then you look, say, at Sayyidatna Aisha, radiallahu anha, who never had children and was the beloved of the chosen one, and who is not going to bow his or her head when they think of Aisha, mother of the believers. So this blaming, shaming, blaming of women for materialistic postponing things. Sometimes they may have their own conversations with themselves, but you can't say that childlessness diminishes your status as a sign of God and as a perfected human being. Who is going to say Aisha kind of missed out? Or it's just not a possible thing for a believer to say. So when we say that there is indicativity in gender of the divine, which is true, and particularly in the female, if you follow Ibn Arabi, he says the greatest manifestation of the divine qualities in this created world is actually the beauty of women, which is the meaning of the Holy Prophet saying, three things are made beloved to me, one of them is women. That means women, not just women who've biologically succeeded in perpetuating their and their husband's genetic material. It is the female estate generally, because that's part of his hubbibat, made beloved to me, and that seems to be very important. Often in some traditional Muslim cultures where they blame women who don't have children, or in the kind of modern manosphere where they blame women for not whatever it might be. Nonetheless, that doesn't mean that there is not a particular charism that attaches to the miracle of conception, the womb, pregnancy, motherhood, all of these unique things that the Quran venerates. That's a particular thing, but that's an eminence, but not to be in that is not a sign of inadequacy, because you have the mothers of the believers who are mothers of the believers, as wajuhu ummahatuhum. So that's a very interesting aspect of Islam. Similarly, the idea of the departure from the primal garden, which in the Western tradition is overwhelmingly blamed on Eve and concupiscence, that's not there in the Quran. فَأَزَلَّهُمَا الشَّيْطَانِ, the shaitan caused them both to slip, doesn't say sin, وَأَخْرَجَهُمَا مِمَّا كَانَا فِي, and caused them to depart from that in which they were. That's pretty important. In the Jansenist movement in French Catholicism, there was a special prayer which a woman was supposed to say while giving birth, saying, this is the curse that is rightly inflicted upon the daughters of Eve, which is a kind of depressing thought when you're in that state. And our tradition really doesn't do that. There's so much about the gender thing in Islam that is subtle. It's not feministic in the contemporary sense, which seems to be at least partly complicit in the biopause, but it really is respectful of the mazhar of the female estate. And so, as we, as a kind of confused and divided ummah, look upon this modern predicament and see the many aspects of this non-communicable disease which flow from childlessness and from familylessness, so that there's a global loneliness epidemic now. 15% of young people in England say they don't have any friends, and that percentage keeps going up, with all of the kind of incel strangeness that seems to be triggering, anxiety, depression, in the case of women, body image questions, cutting, and certain things that people do to their bodies that seem to indicate a kind of enmity towards them, tattooing, a skin rape, as they call it. You go to the dentist, as I did recently, and there's the hygienist, and she's young, but there's a kind of huge black spider on one arm, and then there's a death's head on another, and she's this little blonde girl from somewhere. What is this kind of demonic imagery? Why? What is it in her psyche that makes it appropriate to do that to her skin? Something indicates a profound dissatisfaction with her own being in her own body. All of these tragedies are likely to get worse, and many of you guys probably see their manifestations among non-Muslims and among Muslims, because we're out of kilter with the way our species is designed to be. So, the take home is that we need to see Islam in its retrieval of primordiality as a therapy in itself, not just as a lifestyle option, but as a therapy. That the prayer, the fast, all of these things are profoundly wise ways of reconnecting with what human beings have always done. A life determined by the sun and the moon, a life determined by peaceful engagement with nature, a life determined by family life, by parenthood, by grandparenthood, by the traditional functions of humanity, because these are the achievable accomplishments which historically bring happiness to human beings. None of that was on display in Paris. Everything else, people with, I think, fake smiles, desperation in the society that claims that we are only bodies and then fails to deliver on the most fundamental functionality of the body. So where will this lead? We don't know, but probably to some very fundamental global ructions and inequalities. We can't really imagine it, but Muslims just need to stay cool and not to panic. Panic in the ummah, which is the basis for extremism and stupid, egotistic choices of whatever is narrow in every situation, are the real threat to the ummah. We just need to chill a little bit, relax, be forgiving, Maybe CMC will have a bumper sticker for you next year. Make love, not jihad. We don't really have the courage for that. But inshallah, you know, things will work themselves out because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is with his ummah. All we need to do is be normal human beings. Believe, fast, pray, love our parents, love our children, do kind of obvious things and stop panicking. And inshallah, we can look forward to a bright future and we'll be at ease with ourselves. Barakallahu feekum wal afu minkum. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.